thank you, Jim, for leading us in those beautiful songs whose last names began with A. Those of you students, would you raise your hand, please, if you have not been in a home on one of these Sunday night excursions whose last name begins with A? Would you raise your hand, please? Well, you know, there are not many A's. Well, all right, that's good. Well, this home is at 1004 North, what? Holly. It's just up to marked on that, this invitation. You know, you may not get another one. This may be your chance. It's wonderful. We've had such a good day. We had a wonderful service at the early hour tonight. It's a great privilege to be here with you. And what a beautiful Lord's Day it's been. I said that this morning, but it's been too. In Ephesians, the second chapter and verse 12, the Apostle Paul describes one of the most depressing, tragic aspects of a life of sin and separation from God. He calls these people of the nations, these uncircumcised ones, and he says, remember, remember that once you were separate from Christ, you were alienated from the commonwealth of Israel. You were strangers to the covenants of promise. You were without hope and without God, having no hope and without God in the world. I don't know of a more tragic, depressing realization than this sudden awareness and sensation that people who are separate from God receive when, as life begins to perhaps slip away, and as the years begin to pass, this sickening awareness that, you know, there's no hope. No hope. Some years ago, a submarine sank off the coast of Massachusetts. Ships were called immediately. They came, sent down divers to see if perhaps there was something that they could do to rescue the men entombed or trapped in that submarine. And the men inside the submarine began to signal and talk to those on the outside, the divers, by means of a Morse code. And after several attempts had been made to rescue them, finally there came this very sobering question from within. These men began to knock on the sub, the Morse code question, is there any hope? And what a very, very telling, perhaps more than that, it's a very, very seeking question. Because you see, people don't do very well without hope. Human beings can't live very well without hope. Where there's life, someone says, there's hope. And yet there's a very real reverse of that. It seems that where human beings are concerned, only where there's hope is there much life. Only where there is some hope for continuation, or some hope for success, or some hope in life, only then does life seem to be able to prosper. Human beings aren't able to live without hope. And when their hopeless condition becomes so apparent to themselves that they seem to have lost the will to live, many people have taken their lives. And I would suspect that the most common precedent, or the most common preceding condition to suicide, would be this concept or awareness of hopelessness. What's the use? For those who do not take that tragic step but settle for something less than that, many of them spend the remainder of their lives in a spirit of lackadaisicalness, of disinterestedness, where they just kind of drift through life without any purpose. The spark of life is gone because hope is gone. Tonight, I want to talk to you about it for a few minutes. Jeremiah said, wait a minute, there may yet be hope. Jeremiah was a man who had been through a lot. He'd been put in prison. He'd been sent to Egypt as an exile. He had been sentenced to a certain number of days down in the bottom of a well. He had been threatened. His life had been threatened. He had so many things against him, and he had come to the place that he had said these things: I'm the man who has seen affliction under the rod of his wrath. He has besieged and enveloped me with bitterness and tribulation. He has walled me about so that I cannot escape. He's put heavy chains on me. Though I call and cry for help, he shuts out my prayer. My soul is bereft of peace. I have forgotten what happiness is. So I say, gone is my glory and my hope or expectation from the Lord. But then he saw something. And he says, wait a minute, there may yet be hope. In verse 29, he saw something that caused him to pull up short and say, well, now, there may yet be some hope. I want to speak to you about this evening, because it's that time of the year. It's that time of the semester. It's getting pretty close. And I know full well that there are many of you who perhaps have given up hope. You've got term papers due. You're far behind in your reading. The last test that was given to you was so stupid, nobody would have ever given it, and nobody could pass it. The teacher must have been deranged. You know all the things that you could say about it. But you've come to the place where you just say, well, there's just no hope for me. But wait a minute, there may be hope after all. I want you to see some things tonight, not necessarily that Jeremiah saw, but some things that are related to, and in the Bible, they are related to us. And they are related so much to life that perhaps if you can see them, not just as a student, but middle-aged people need this lesson. Because we sometimes fall the most victim to these thoughts of hopelessness. But I want you to see some things. Perhaps it'll give you hope tonight. One thing that's stated in Proverbs, the 13th chapter and verse 12, is this: hope deferred makes the heart sick. Hope deferred makes the heart sick. Did you ever have a dream? Perhaps you had fever and you were delirious. And in this dream, someone was chasing you. But there up ahead was the place where you could go and hide. And there was the one place that you could get out of the storm or get away from the man that was chasing you or this beast that was after you. And all of a sudden, you're right at the door, and you're clawing for the door, and you spend all night reaching for that door. But it never does. You never do get to it. You're always just one bit of way away from it. Oh, that's so frustrating. It makes the heart sick. Do you realize that many, many people in this sin-sick world that we're living in today, they experience that not as a dream, but as a reality? And it's a nightmare for them. There are many people all over the world, in every age, in every nation, who find that their life is one continuing grasping for something that never does really ever come about. And it makes the heart sick. In John the 5th chapter, there's a man there whom the Lord saw at the pool of Bethesda. And he had been sick for 38 years. I don't know how many of those years he had been frequenting the pool of Bethesda, but there was a certain tradition among the Jews that as the waters of this pool bubbled occasionally, that the first one who got to the waters after the waters bubbled would be healed. It was just a tradition. But nevertheless, it was a tradition that was believed by these people and that gave them some hope and that kept bringing them back day after day, month after month, year after year, to hope perhaps that today will be the day that I'll be able to be healed. This poor man, Jesus knew that he'd been sick for 38 years. He knew that he'd been sick a long, long time, and that he'd been hoping and hoping and hoping year after year. Jesus went up to him and said, would you be made well? And this dear old soul said, sir, whenever the waters are troubled and I try to get down to them, every time I try, somebody else gets there before me. Which simply was a pouring out of his heart to say, I've hoped for so long, and it just doesn't seem like I ever get to that pool in time to be healed. And so many people are like that. I think every community has its Bethesda pool. I think every city has its Bethesda pool, around which the outcasts of humanity and these people who perhaps have been deprived of those circumstances in their lives with which you've been blessed, that gave you a head start, so many people on the skid row, so many people in the ghettos, so many people who are poor, who are untrained, who don't have parents. So many of them more or less congregate and huddle in masses around these little pockets of humanity all over the world and wait, hoping that something will happen to change their plight. And so many times, however, it never does come about. And that kind of hope, if it's allowed to go long enough, if it's deferred long enough, the writer says, it makes the heart sick. And if enough of this is taking place and your heart becomes sick enough, that's what makes these long, hot summers, where people burst out of that in desperation. They take things in their own hands. They began to take the law in their own hands many times in sheer desperation to say, I'm going to take it, whether you want me to or not, and whether you'll allow me to or not, I'm going to have it. Because hope deferred makes the heart sick. But all over life, it's like that. There are these Bethesda pools, I think, all through life. We find it in our own homes. I think every home has its Bethesda pool. When you young people get married, you can laugh with us older ones as to how the financial solvency always is one step away, you know. Next year, we're going to make it. The car is going to be paid off. We won't have any more car payment. The new suit we bought, that's going to be paid off. And each one of these bills, you know, and next year is the year. This is the year we're going to be able to make it and keep our nose above the water. But you'll laugh about it too. It never comes. Something always happens. For example, it may be that you've gotten down to saying next month. You know, it's almost here. Next month is the month. But next month somebody falls on a rock and breaks a tooth out and has to go to the dentist, and there's $150 just out the window, you see. Every month that it comes along, something happens that keeps this thing of being financially free just one step away from it, one month away always. How many of you middle-aged people, having raised 4 or 5 children, and your youngest child is about 8 years old or 9, and the wife and the husband say, oh boy, this is it. Our baby's is in the first grade now. We're all right. We're going to be free of the responsibility of raising children. The wife says, I just feel liberated. I'm so happy to be free and no more babies around the house. And you go to the doctor and you come back and he says, mm-hmm. And that hurts right in here. It just literally gets to you. It just makes you sick. If you haven't experienced that, you don't know what I'm talking about. But if you have, you know what I'm talking about. Deferred hope makes the heart sick. It really gets to you. But there's so many other ways that this hope deferred affects us. It affects people on the campus. It affects people in our businesses. Jimmy, if we could just say, this one flock of chickens, if I can just get them in the house, if I can just do that and get all these eggs to the market while the price of eggs is high, I'm going to get out of debt. But it's always, and that was last year, but it's this year too, isn't it? And it's going to be next year probably. On campus, whenever we talk about it, we've got tests, you know, that we're taking. If I can just get one good grade on this test, I think I'll come out with a pretty good average. Or if I can just get this term paper in, this one's going to be the one. I'm going to be all right. Now, if I can just get past this week, well, you find that that's not really the case, that there'll be something else the next week and something else the next week. And when it comes to looking for your mate, how many of you boys have just looked and looked and you get shot out of the saddle whenever you ask some of them, you know, and they're looking for some knight in shining armor and they don't know what to expect. And here we go. And nobody really, everybody's always looking for something they can't quite grab a hold of. Hope deferred makes the heart sick. A girl told me the other day she had asked 5 boys to go with her to a banquet. 5. One, she asked, he wanted to go but couldn't. Another one had a conflict. 3rd and 4th. She said, if I hadn't really been interested, I wouldn't have asked this 5th one. But she said, there he is, and I'm going to go get him. And she went and got him 5 times, and it paid off. Hope deferred, though, had just about made her give up. She just about had given up because of this hope being deferred. And you know, so many of these things are so very serious. A young man the other day asked me, he said, I'm 25 years old. And he wouldn't mind me telling you this. He said, is there any hope that I'll find my mate? Well, you know, it makes the heart sick, this continual deferring of hope. Unless you become distraught over the fact or over the appearing that you're not ever going to receive the fruition of your hope. Lest you become so despondent and down in the dumps, let me tell you something else about hope. You may have to adjust your hope. You may have to adjust it. In Romans, the 15th chapter, in verse 9, the apostle, or verse 24, the apostle Paul there makes the statement, I hope to see you on my way to Spain. And he was talking to the Roman Christians. Paul had already had his hope to see the Roman Christians deferred many times. In verses 9 and 10 and 13, he makes these statements of chapter 1. For God is my witness, whom I serve with my spirit in the gospel of his Son, that without ceasing to, I mention you always in my prayers, asking that somehow, by God's will, I may now at last succeed in coming to you. And then verse 13, I want you to know, brethren, that I have often intended to come to you, but thus far have been prevented. He's just simply saying here, I have hoped many, many times to be able to come see you, but I just never have been able to do it. Now that's hope deferred. And yet, Paul did get to see those brethren. He had had high hopes of coming under different circumstances. But the thing I want to show you about the Apostle Paul and his hope is that he got to see them, but it was under different circumstances than those that he had planned. Paul never did get to realize the fruition of those hopes of going to Spain on that particular journey and coming by and spending a few leisurely days or weeks with these Roman Christians and then going on over to sunny Spain. He never did realize the fruition of those hopes. You know why? He went to prison instead. What a change in his plans. Oh, he saw these Romans, all right, but not under the circumstances that he had wished to see them under. He had seen them in the sense that he had gone to jail. He was in prison, and they came to see him in prison. Nobody forbade them to come, but nevertheless, it was under different circumstances. But Paul had to adjust to it. You know, most people have to adjust their hopes. Someone said, Mr. Allen, who wrote a book on the miracle of hope, made this statement. He said, everybody has to accept a second or third choice in life. Do you believe that? I think it's true. One man after the early service came to me and said, you know, I have accepted the ninth choice of my life as my vocation. It was my ninth choice. He said, you're right. We do have to accept a second or third choice. Not in everything, but in some things. If you don't believe it, look at the husbands that some of these wives married. That certainly wasn't their first choice, you know. You look at them. Bald-headed and wrinkled and all, that wasn't their first choice. But they finally accepted this second choice. He may have pestered them to death, you know, until finally they said, well, anybody that's persistent, there must be something to them. But you're going to have to learn how to adjust your choices. You're going to have to learn how to adjust your hopes. If you don't, you're going to be miserable because you're not going to be able to marry necessarily that prima donna that you've been looking for. You may have to marry somebody that's not so prima and get a donna that's not so prima. But you're going to have to adjust it, or else be miserable. Or else go through life looking for something really that's unrealistic. You know, the idea that most boys have, they're going to marry the girl, and she's going to be the number one, and she's going to be totally and absolutely and devastatingly beautiful, and she's going to be intelligent, and she's going to be submissive, and she's going to be all these things all wrapped up in one, and he's going to come in here, sweep her off her feet, and take her away. Well, that probably won't be the way you'll do it. And she probably won't be the one you get to do that to. And she probably won't even be the one you need. You'd be surprised how much at a loss we men would be if we got the first woman that we thought we really and truly had to have. I'm so thankful I didn't. I'm so thankful I settled for a second choice. I'm serious. That didn't come out right. But I'm serious. Don't you tell her. No, I'm serious. Your first love, you seldom ever really marry your first love. You marry a second love or a third on down the line. And you girls, don't expect this knight in shining armor to appear as a knight in shining armor. I know one thing. If some of the women who had been wanting to marry some of the men that they wanted to marry, if they had been allowed to marry them, they would have been totally miserable. Because that just wasn't the man they needed. There's someone else that's coming along that you really need. But he may not appear to be what you think he should be. You may have to look under that dirty t-shirt to see him, to see that knight in shining armor, and to see that diamond in the rough. You may need to do some looking. Someone the other day complimented me on, they said, how lucky you are to have your wife. But my wife very wisely said, but he is not married now to the woman that he first married. I'm a different person. And how wonderful it is that we can grow, and how great and powerfully she's grown into a mature Christian woman, and she's been waiting on me to grow equally, and I'm afraid I haven't grown as fast. But I'm simply saying this, you may have to adjust your hopes. Can you do that? Paul did. In that prison cell, he said, I have learned in whatever state I'm in to be content. Boy, that's a jewel. You're talking about a priceless possession. I've learned in whatever state I'm in to be content. I've learned how to be abased. I've learned how to abound. Paul said, my hopes might be one direction, but I've had to settle for some other things. But doesn't matter. Whatever state I'm in, I'm content. And he wrote to the Romans earlier in that letter and said, all things work together for good to those that love the Lord. Do you believe that? Oh, so many of you come with high hopes of doing so many things. Some of you come with high hopes to be medical doctors. Others come with high hopes to be one thing or the other. One girl said, I'm going to be a medical doctor. She told me last year. The next semester she came back and said, well, I'm having to settle to be just simply a lab technician. But she had accepted it. And she was the happier for it. She wasn't able to do the other work. And she said, I can do this one. This morning, a young man was sitting in the pew early, about a half an hour before services. And I went out and sat down beside him and said, how are you doing in school? He said, all right. He said, I'm not making necessarily the grades that I want to make. But he says, I'm doing the best I can. And if I don't do the very best that I, at least if I don't get the grade that I really want, he said, I've learned to be satisfied and to accept the lower grade. And he was just as peaceful and content because he learned how to adjust his hope. You're going to have to do the same thing. Enterprise, Alabama is a very interesting example of this. Enterprise is a little town in Coffee County in Alabama. And in the square of this little town, there is a statue. And it's a statue of a woman standing there, and in her hand, there is a replica of a boll weevil. And underneath that statue is this inscription, in profound appreciation of the boll weevil and what he has done as the herald of prosperity. Now, you won't understand it unless you understand the background of Coffee County. Coffee County at one time was a great cotton-growing county. And they just grew cotton, and the farmers just literally grew rich. And they were just raking it in until Mr. Boll Weevil came looking for a home. And he found it in Coffee County, Alabama. And he just literally ate them out of house and home, just wiped them clean right off the slate, and they didn't have anything. They tried again maybe the next year, and they just couldn't work it. He came back again and just destroyed the whole thing. I don't know how many years they tried. And this thing of this evasive hope, or this hope deferred, kept being one year ahead of them. You know, they never could realize what was the fruition of their hope. Until finally, somebody said, I'm going to try to plant peanuts. And they planted peanuts in that old Alabama clay. And I'm telling you, it had just been waiting to be planted. That stuff just literally grew like weeds. Well, those people just became rich overnight from having substituted or accepted a lesser or perhaps another hope than that which they had originally hoped for. So they erected that and said, least we can do is just erect a monument to Mr. Boll Weevil for having caused us to go in a different direction. And they had this deferred hope of theirs realized in the sense that they just changed hopes and accepting a second choice. And you're going to have to do that same thing too. There's a third thing about hope that I want you to notice tonight. And that is, there are times when it looks like hope is dead. It looks like there is no more hope. When every avenue has been exhausted, when every stone has been turned, it seems that there's no more hope. In the book of Luke, chapter 24, these two men on the way back to Emmaus, after the crushing events of that Friday, after the burial that Friday afternoon, these men were on their way back to Emmaus. A stranger met them, and you know the beautiful story there. And he said, what are you men talking so seriously about? And they said, are you the only sojourner, the only pilgrim in Jerusalem that doesn't know the things that have happened there recently? And he said, what things? And they said, why, the things about Jesus of Nazareth, this man, this prophet, mighty in word and deed, how that he was killed. And they told him the story of what had happened to Jesus Christ. And then they made this very pitiful statement. But we had hoped that he would be the one to redeem Israel. We had hoped. Now that's in the past tense. And it just simply means that their hope was dead. All of their hopes of the Redeemer, all of their hopes of the Messiah were now crushed. They died when this man died. Dead hope. And as far as they were concerned, it was all over. There was no more. Have you ever felt like that? There's a man by the name of Carlyle, Thomas Carlyle. The story goes that he hit on some hard times. And during those days of depression and poverty, Thomas Carlyle sat down and wrote his volume on the history of the French Revolution. He asked a man, a friend of his, after he had finished it, James Mill, asked him if he would read it. And Mr. Mill agreed to read it. He brought him the manuscript and left it with him. And that night, Mr. Mill sat down in front of a big roaring fire in his study and sat there comfortably and began to read that manuscript that this man had written over these years. And as he would read it, he would lay the pages beside his chair and became engrossed and recognized it, the story says, as a masterpiece. He read all night long, laying those pages beside him as he read that beautiful manuscript. Early the next morning, he arose from the chair, exhausted, went over and laid down in his bed. The maid came in and, seeing these scattered pages, scooped them up and put them in the fire and destroyed them. She thought they were just rubbish. When Carlyle was told, the story goes, that he became so despondent, he was so shocked, he was so depressed, his hope was just shattered, he vowed he would never write again, never. The story says that he would sit in front of his picture window just staring into space. But one day he began to notice a man building a brick wall. And he saw how this man would just take a brick and put it on the wall, and he'd take another brick and put it on the wall. And all of a sudden something began to happen. A dead hope began to be resurrected. And he took new life, and he said, all right, I'll begin to write again. I'll just write one page at a time, just one page at a time. So he did. And writing one page at a time, the man again recreated that had been destroyed, and his hope was born again. And I've thought how many times things in your life are going to be such that they would just literally crush you, leave you staring out the window, leaving you with no hope. And yet hope will recur, it will revive if you'll just give it a chance. Sometimes it doesn't happen. In 1926 in Washington, D.C., a very strange auction took place. It was in the Patent Office of the United States, and they auctioned off 150,000 unsuccessful inventions. And these inventions, that each one been represented by what you would call a model. And the model had been submitted to the Patent Office to be reviewed to see if it could be patented and if it was in account. And these were 150 unsuccessful ones that just simply weren't worth anything. Such things as a bed bug buster. I don't know what it consisted of, but it was a bed bug buster, you know, pow, just kill him wherever you find him. Another one was an electrical illuminated cat that you plug in at night to scare the mice. And things like that. Stupid, really. And every one of these 150,000, whenever they were auctioned off, it says that they just produced a haw-haw. You know, just the whole audience just roared like you did a minute ago. And yet every one of those 150,000, though they were laughed at, every last one of them was laughed at. Every last one of those 150,000 unsuccessful inventions represented a tear, every one of them, and represented a broken dream and a broken hope. Many of those people never did try to invent anything else, I'm sure. They had invested everything they had in that bed bug buster. They had put everything they had in that illuminated cat, and whenever he failed, they just didn't have any heart to go any further. But hope will revive if you'll allow it. You know the parable of the prodigal son? He had high hopes, didn't he? He had high hopes that he was going to go off from his father's house and he was going to have a real rich and full life. He was going to live it up. He was going where happiness was. This was it. This was where he was at, and he was going there. But you know, it didn't take him long till he ended up broke. And then just one short step further, he was there in the pig pen. Hope gone. Hope dead. And there he sat. So hungry, it says, that he could actually have filled his belly with the pods that these swine ate. Nobody gave him anything. But then something happened. Hope revived. Hope revived in this man, just like it revived in those two men on the way to Emmaus. The master there, who had been raised from the dead, took them and began to go through the scriptures and tell them all the things that had been written of him in the prophets. And their hope came back to life.
hope in this prodigal son was revived just like the hope in Carlisle was revived as he saw this one brick at a time being placed upon these various, upon the wall. Well, hope in this young boy revived. You know what it caused it to revive? He began to smell the bread on his daddy's table. He began to think about the bread. He said, how many servants of my father's have bread enough and to spare? And I perish here with hunger. I'm going home. And you know how he started? Just one step at a time. Just one. He couldn't get there all at once. Carlisle could not have reproduced that book all at once. But he could do it one page at a time. And that young man could go back home just one step at a time. I don't know how you are tonight. I don't know where your hopes are. I don't know how depressed you may be. It may be that hope has been deferred so long that your heart is totally sick. You may need to adjust your hope and to accept a second, more realistic hope than your other very idealistic hope. But it may be that if hope has just been literally killed and you find that there's no chance, there's no hope left, would you put your trust in God? That's what Jeremiah did when he said, there may yet be hope. He said, I thought about this, and then my heart had hope. He thought about the loving kindness of God and how it's new every day. And he says, I'm trusting in the Lord. He said, there may yet be hope. You may find in your life that you've been crushed. You may find that your life has been crushed. You may find that this yearning in your own heart for godliness has always been deferred one more day. One more day, because each day there's a sin that keeps plaguing you, or several sins that keep tripping you up, and you can't quite seem to reach it until the point has come that you just don't have any hope. It may be that your very life has been crushed to the point that you're giving up in despair. But don't. There's hope yet. And just like the prodigal son, you know what you can do? It just takes one step. Just one step at a time. It just takes one page at a time. If you'll just step out in the aisle, that one step is all that the prodigal took at first. Just one. Boy, whenever that one was taken, here came another one behind it. And then another one behind it. And each one got easier than the one before it. That's the way hope revives. I wish you were here tonight. And if you are, if you're hopeless, if you're depressed, if you seem that there's just no way out, would you come back tonight to your Father? It just takes starting one step at a time, and you'll have hope. There'll be a promised reward. There'll be success, but you've just got to not give up hope. Is there any hope? Oh, yes. As long as there's life, as long as there's God, as long as Jesus Christ lives and loves, there's hope. Would you be the prodigal who would just simply return tonight one step at a time and let this hope, whatever it may be, let it begin to be resurrected and revived as you respond to God tonight, just one step at a time? Would you come while we sing?
As I am with